It's time for TWiT This Week in Tech, and boy, do we've got an episode for you. A lot of legal stuff, anti-cyberbullying, a little bit of courtroom drama over the patent troll, Microsoft's newest watch, a lot of legal stuff. Another TWiT is next.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Tech is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is TWiT, This Week in Tech, episode 465, recorded Sunday, July 6th, 2014. Let's ask the audience. This Week in Tech is brought to you by IT Pro TV. Are you looking to upgrade your IT skills or prepare for certification? IT Pro TV offers engaging and informative tutorials streamed to your Roku, computer, or mobile device. For 30% off the lifetime of your account, go to itpro.tv/twit and use the code TWIT30 and buy NatureBox. Order great-tasting, healthy snacks delivered right to your door. Forget the vending machine and get in shape with healthy, delicious treats like roasted garlic pumpkin seeds. To get 50% off your first box, go to naturebox.com/twit. That's naturebox.com/twit. And by audible.com. Sign up for the Platinum Plan and get 2 free books. Go to audible.com/twit2. Follow Audible on Twitter. User ID audible_com. And by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create your own professional website or online portfolio. For a free 2-week trial and 10% off, go to squarespace.com and use the offer code TWIT. It's time for TWIT This Week in Tech. It's the show where we take the tech news of the week, load it in a mortar, shoot it up into the sky, and let the sparklies sprinkle down on us like the ash of yesteryear gone past. I'm Father Robert Ballasaire, the digital Jesuit, in for Leo Laporte, the tech guy, who's currently in Hawaii. We don't know why, but we assume there are wonderful things a-coming. Joining me today, starting on my right, Mr. Harry McCracken from The Technologizer. Harry, are we allowed to talk about your future announcement?
Yes. As of 2 weeks from tomorrow, I will be technology editor for Fast Company, which I'm excited about.
You do look a lot happier right now. You've got this the glow of a geek who's had the world lifted from your shoulders.
Well, I'm excited about it. I've been a fan of Fast Company since the first issue came out, which I think was 19 years ago. And we're talking about doing all kinds of cool stuff.
Nice. And, you know, it's always nice to be able to walk into someplace and sort of build something on your own.
They're doing cool stuff.
Yeah. Speaking of building something on your own, this man is no stranger to doing just that. We bring in Steve Kovach, the senior tech editor at Business Insider. Steven, thank you for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Now, we were talking about this right before the show. I think I had a conversation with you way back when, sometime in January. You seem to recall that we were talking about Microsoft, but I remember you didn't have that really cool brick background. Did you build that just for us?
No, I kind of shifted things around in my living room a little bit to get that dark stand-up comic vibe, I guess, like I'm in some sort of comedy cellar. But if I turn it around, we can see the vinyl in my apartment if you guys want to check it out.
Oh, no. See, now you broke the fourth wall. Now, we were all imagining that you were somewhere in an Ivy League dorm
room
somewhere.
Like a bunker or something.
Yeah. Well,
just my apartment.
We'll just have to imagine now. Well, gentlemen, what do you say we get down to the tech news? No, that was a question. Okay. This first one is all about Google. Now, we all know that the EU broke the internet 2 months ago. At least, okay, that's what the press was saying. We were all saying that the right to be forgotten was going to be a fundamental mistake, that it was going to destroy the way that the internet worked, and we were all going to have to go back to chiseling things into tablets with rocks and whatever those chisel things. I don't know what tools are. I use a computer. But anyways, it didn't break the internet. But it did make a mess of it, and it seems like Google is exacerbating the mess. Now, we may remember that 2 months ago, the top EU court backed the right to be forgotten as a fundamental, a principal right of every EU citizen. It told Google that it was responsible for deleting inadequate, irrelevant, or no longer relevant data from its search results when requested to do so by members of the public. Now, there was that public outcry. There was a lot of experts who said that this was either a good thing or a bad thing, but we kind of forgot it. Well, Google is bringing it back into our mind view because a lot of stuff has happened since then. The test case was first brought against Google by Spanish citizen Mario Costella Gonzalez, who wanted to delete links to a listing for an auction for his house, which had been foreclosed because of debt. Well, he said that was back in 1998. I don't have those debts anymore. I've paid those debts, and I don't want that to be the first thing that pops into a search result when someone types my name. The EU court agreed, and they told Google, you got to take it down. Now, simple, right? Easy. Done with. No, not so much. Since the ruling, there has been a rush to invoke the right to be forgotten. There was a politician who no longer wanted his behavior in office to be linked with his name. There was a doctor who wanted poor reviews removed from her search. A pedophile who wanted information about his conviction deleted. An actor who wanted articles about his affair with a teenager to be unlinked. An individual who tried to murder his family who thought the public shouldn't know about that. A cyberstalker, a suspended university professor, and the list goes on and on. In fact, all told, since the court agreed with the right to be forgotten, there have been 70,000 requests to remove more than 275 individual listings, with most requests coming from France, Germany, the UK, Spain, and Italy. Now, I want to throw this over to you first, Steve. This was kind of what we were expecting, right? I mean, when the EU said that, yes, you have a right to be forgotten, we knew there was going to be a rush for all these people who had been waiting for years and years for a way to get that stuff off the internet to bum rush the front doors. Is this more or less what we expected?
Yeah, I don't think this is a surprise, especially a lot of those examples you named where people, you know, either charged with crimes or convicted of crimes or have some sort of nefarious, shady past that they want to hide. And, you know, as a journalist, I'm very against this. So, you know, I'm super pro First Amendment, and this does amount to censorship in effect. Yes, those websites still exist, but you got to remember that Google is a utility, that it's the gateway to the internet for a lot of people. I mean, even on my own site, we notice so much traffic comes to Business Insider just from people who can't figure out how to type it in the URL bar. They go to Google and literally just type in Business Insider. So, you know, Google is this gateway for so many people to access information. And the fact that people can essentially censor it themselves out, especially criminals and so forth, you know, that's harmful to just the public good in general. And so it's not a surprise that a lot of these types of people we're seeing are coming forth, you know, tens of thousands of people. And I feel like it's only going to accelerate until maybe someone challenges it with some stricter standards of what can be removed.
Right. Well, Harry, we're seeing about 1,000 new requests submitted each day. But what about that? Is this censorship? I mean, because I mentioned all the bad things, right? Of course, you've got people who want to get their bad behavior off the internet. But the reason why the EU court decided that this was a fundamental right was because there is sort of a statute of limitations. I mean, if I was in debt 20 years ago, but I'm no longer in debt, why should that be the first thing that people find when they Google my name? Or if I had a job and I did poorly at that job and there was some sort of scandal, some sort of brouhaha, but now I'm in a job which has nothing to do with what I used to do, should that haunt me forever? Is it censorship or is this just prudent trimming of data?
Well, there are certainly scenarios in which it's easy to be sympathetic with the people who are unhappy about having their stuff up. But this is yet another example of governments not being very good at creating laws which apply to technology. And I mean, it sounds like the EU was just so incredibly vague about this that all kinds of people are able to take advantage of it, including people who did things which you should know about, whether it's 20 or 30 years later. I mean, I feel like if you were accused of a crime and found innocent, that's one thing. I can sort of plausibly see how you might have laws relating to that information. If you were convicted of a crime, though, I don't see how it's Google's problem if people know about it. I feel like in the old days, it is true that things you did in your past sort of disappeared over time. And that's just not going to be true today moving forward. Because of technology, stuff is not going to disappear. And I think the world sort of has to figure out how to deal with that. I think human beings should forgive people. I mean, if somebody's house was foreclosed upon 15 or 20 years ago, that probably doesn't matter very much if they've had a nice record since then. But it's up to the humans to deal with that, not to the search engine.
Let me add another layer onto this, because I don't think the idea itself is horrible. I don't think that the right to be forgotten is something that will destroy the internet. I But I just think it was very clumsily implemented. In fact, the problem that they're finding right now is that the EU issued such broad rules when they made this law, when they went down with this decision, that essentially Google and the other search engines can do whatever they want. Right now, remember, what they told Google was that Google was responsible for making sure that information that was inaccurate, inadequate, irrelevant, or no longer relevant could be removed from the internet on the request of the individual. But they never defined what those are. So if you don't define what that means, then that means Google is now in this position where they have to act like the censor. Steve, I want to throw this back over to you. If you're told to do something, but then they don't tell you exactly how to do it, and it's now up to you to decide how it works, what the criteria is going to be, when it gets implemented, how fast it's going to work, then you really have no expectations of blame on yourself, right?
Right. I think you nailed it right there when you said it was overly broad, and that's exactly what this is. It can be interpreted so many different ways. For example, one of my colleagues, he's going through the process. He's in the EU right now. He's our London editor, and he's going through the process right now just to see what it's like. He was mentioned in a book kind of negatively not too long ago, and he's trying to get that link to in Google Books removed. And again, it's he was a critic of this company he was writing about, and then this person wrote about him. Hardly a bad thing. It's easy to find and so forth. But it seems like it's something he'll be able to get removed because he can argue that it's damaging to his reputation. And, you know, especially someone like us who make our living, you know, in the public, you know, writing publicly and so forth, that's very damaging just to the public good at large. And so, yeah, I think it's overly broad. And I think eventually we're going to have to get to a point where someone challenges this again and says to the EU courts, hey, you know, let's get a little bit more specific here and figure out exactly, okay, in strict terms, what can and can't be censored out of these things.
All right. I think we need to clarify what you can remove, too, because it's, again, that's a little clumsy. They're figuring it out. But right now, you can remove a link to your name. So if someone searched for Robert Ballister, and I don't like the fact that the very first search result is a picture of me holding bacon in a very strange way. I can say, no, Google, no, get rid of this. This is not relevant. People don't need to know about that. Google would be obligated, if I was in the EU, to remove that link to me holding the bacon because it was a hot day. I was naked. It was strange. But if someone put bacon Ballister, I could still find the search result. Or someone searched a different country search engine, they could still find me there. So it's not like the data is destroyed. It's just the link is destroyed. Harry, let's talk a little bit about that because there's been a lot of focus on, well, it's not censorship because you can still find it if you know where the site is. You just won't be able to search for it through our service.
Well, almost all of us are extremely dependent on this one company's search engine these days to do that. And it's a fascinating question. If there was a little bit more competition in search engines, how would they deal with that? Because right now, if you can't be found in Google, then you can't be found to a great extent. And of course, I mean, the definition of relevance is so incredibly vague. Stuff that to you is irrelevant, to me might be very relevant.
Right, right. Steve, what about that? I mean, if you can't be found in Google, then you can't be found. That's actually a pervasive argument. People are saying, wait a minute, you know, if you're not giving me the ability to be searched for, then I might as well not have a site. I might as well not have a presence on the internet. But is that the same thing as saying that I'm censoring you?
That's an interesting question too, because kind of like I said, you know, it's censoring in the sense that, you know, there's a lot of public information out there that should be known. Like you mentioned, cases about pedophiles and so forth. That stuff is incredibly relevant to the public interest, and it's censoring in the narrow scope of people just in the EU. But like you even said, you can noodle around with the searches, and also keep in mind, it's not censorship in the sense that, you know, those sites still exist. Google isn't just showing them to you. You know, Google isn't like, you know, when you search Steve Kovac, you might not, you only see the good stuff, the only stuff that in the EU that I want you to see. So it's censorship through Google. And like I even said, Google is such an important utility And with, and like Harry said, with very little competition, that it's the default knowledge engine for so many people. It's what people go to find everything from how to make spaghetti to just get information on, you know, the latest news and learn about people, especially, you know, important, relevant news to the day. So it's censorship in that sense, but it's, you know, you got to keep in mind for the rest of the world, these links still do exist.
Right. Now, let's get a little bit away from the theoretical here, because people always have a problem with, oh, well, we haven't really seen the harm. This, you know, yeah, you say all these bad things are going to happen. Nothing's happened. Let's look at some of the things that have happened in the 2 months since the EU backed the right to be forgotten. First, an article written by economist Robert Preston about the 2007 Merrill Lynch subprime mortgage disaster was removed because the former Merrill Lynch chairman, Stan O'Neill, who was the only person mentioned in the article, said, wait a minute, I don't work for Merrill Lynch anymore. I don't want this linking to my name. And they pulled it down. Six Guardian articles were taken down, including three by about Dougie McDonald, who was a football ref who was forced to resign after a possible match-fixing scandal. And three newspapers, including the Daily Mail, have had stories pulled down by people who were mentioned in the stories but no longer wanted to be associated with whatever news was in those stories. Now, they're being very vague deliberately because they don't want us to see exactly what the content was. But it seems to me that we're now getting real concrete information about how this is working, which is, I'm sure it's doing some good. I'm sure there's some very outdated information that's being pulled down. But again, because there are no guidelines, you've got this the law of unintended consequences where, you know what, it probably would be good to know that Stan O'Neill was involved with the Merrill Lynch meltdown. That's not outdated information, but Google gets to make the decision. Harry, what's wrong with that?
Well, you know, in any one case, you could plausibly see Google thinking it over and coming to a rational decision. But for 70,000 cases, the only way you could possibly deal with that is if you had an enormous infrastructure and essentially like a court system to look at every instance and figure out whether it made sense or not. And of course, the more it comes down to hearing about cases in which media companies had stories pulled about powerful people, the more bothersome it is, because it really is censorship.
Okay.
It's censorship for the 21st century.
Steve, I want to get your input on this. There are people who are saying that Google is deliberately doing sort of reductio ad absurdum here. They don't have to cooperate as quickly as they've been cooperating with the ruling. In fact, people are saying, look at Yahoo, look at Bing. They're all very slow to respond. So they understand how the rule works, but the rule also doesn't have a time frame. So they're moving very slowly on requests, whereas Google has just been whipping through them. And they're saying, well, Google is at fault because they don't have to take the ruling so literally. But it seems to me that that's not Google's problem. If you make a law, they can comply with the law. I mean, I don't understand why. Yeah, I mean, it seems like they're getting a bad
Google's
rub
fault.
Here.
Yeah, they are. I think you know, they were put in a sticky situation, and the last thing they want to do is wind up in court again. But what the EU did is put them in a situation where they're basically the arbiter, and they get to go case by case. Okay, do we block the link to the Merrill guy? Do we block the link to the pedophile? Do we block the link to this guy who couldn't pay off his loans or something? And do we, you know, does the EU really want Google to be deciding this kind of stuff that they're, like Harry said, like this court system? It puts them in such a sticky situation, and it isn't their fault. I think right now, if anything, they're erring on the side of caution and just, you know, accepting all these requests as fast as they can. And they're probably getting way more requests than Bing is, because they have such a large chunk of the market share in search.
Well, don't worry, because Bing will actually be copying the requests that Google has. So anytime Google takes something, no, let's not go there. They don't do that anymore. All right. Okay. Yeah. So I want to close this up, because we spent a lot of time talking about the right to be forgotten, the unintended consequences. But let me ask both of you, would something like this ever work in the United States?
We have a real different philosophy about a lot of this stuff. Like in the UK, you can slander somebody by writing something about them, which is true. Totally different from over here, where slander by definition is saying something that's not true. So I think we've always had, you know, a way more liberal attitude on this stuff. And it's kind of hard to imagine anything this broad happening here.
Right.
Again, if it's incorrect information, maybe. But stuff you just don't like being up about you because it puts you in a bad light. I don't see it happening.
Yeah, Steve, what about that? I mean, because we already have strong laws for slander. Would this even be required in the United States? I mean, if someone says something untrue about you, you have legal recourse to go against them. But if someone just reports news about something, you shouldn't be able to take that down.
Right. It's only slander if it's false. And so, again, I completely agree with Harry. This would never happen in the U.S. just because we have, it's the First Amendment, freedom of speech, and that there are protections for people against slander and libel. But again, it has to be false information. So maybe if some kind of case comes through where someone wants false information taken down, but even then they'd go after the individual outlet. So, that's not a problem for Google to solve. I've been a journalist in both London and the United States, and Harry nailed it. I mean, the laws are completely different over there, especially in the UK. You can write something true and still get in legal trouble. We're very lucky and fortunate to live in a country that lets journalists and the freedom of speech operate the way it does. So I think we're pretty safe.
Let's hope so.
I know there's very patriotic and July 4th, but I actually do believe it.
Well, I mean, you may have the right to be forgotten in the United States, but the NSA won't forget you. So.
Exactly.
Yeah, let's bring that back in. No, we're not going to talk about that. In fact, let's go to something a bit more fun. Cuckoo for Cocoa Puffs. Specifically, sticks and stones may break your bones, but Apple can't call you a troll. Like last week, the U.S. District Judge Lucy Koh, you may remember her from the Apple-Samsung Blockbuster case. Well, she issued a no-name-calling rule in the Apple GPNE case. Now, GPNE is a non-practicing entity. It's what we normally call a patent troll. It's a corporation formed with the sole purpose of acquiring IP, which they then use to go after other companies who are actually making things. That's what they do. They sort of shotgun a bunch of litigation, and hopefully someone will pay up. Now, in this particular case, GPNE has acquired multiple patents that vaguely, very vaguely address mobile communications. For example, Chad, if you have this up, U.S. patent 7555267, which describes a central office with some form of two-way paging. This, if you scroll down to the, the link above from GigaOM, it shows you the what the vision was for this, and it's essentially using a bunch of pagers with some receivers so you could have two-way paging. They're using that as a way to claim that they own Apple's communications technologies, and Apple therefore needs to pay up. Now, in any other circumstance, we would call that a patent troll. But in this case, Lucy Koh has said not only can they not call them a patent troll during the trial, but Apple can also not call them a pirate, a bounty hunter, a privateer, a bandit, a paper, a patent, stick up, shakedown, playing the lawsuit lottery, corporate shell game, or corporate shell. Now, Steve, I want to throw this over to you first. It sounds as if what Lucy's trying to do is she's trying to make sure that there's no defamatory language or there's no biased language in the courtroom. But, I mean, is patent troll really all that surprising to people who might be listening to this case?
No, it's become such common vernacular. And these companies, like you said, are designed just to look through patents and see what they can snap up and then sue for and make money. It's calling a spade, and it's such a common phrase these days that I don't think it's that bad. Now, maybe the thing like shell corporation or pirate and so forth, maybe those are a little derogatory and shouldn't be used in the courtroom. But, even the White House has said patent troll. I think that's safe to say that they're pretty unbiased in a lot of these things. So I'm okay with them, Apple calling this company a patent troll, but I think Koh is right to kind of tamp down the rest of that harsh language.
And that's the amazing part, because the White House commission, the fact sheet that you got from the commission about patent reform, they actually use the phrase patent troll. So evidently patent troll cannot be used in a courtroom, but it's just fine for the president of the United States. Harry, I really don't understand this. I mean, is it just because she doesn't want leaning, she doesn't want a mistrial, she doesn't want to worry about legal ramifications later on? Because it seems strange to remove words from the courtroom.
Well, I'm reasonably sympathetic with her. They are patent trolls. I certainly don't have a problem with the White House saying so. But a courtroom should be about decorum, and it should, I mean, it, I think it's fine to say that you don't want emotionally charged words being applied, because the job of the court is to determine the facts of the case. And to me, we are not at a point where calling somebody a patent troll is not a judgment and a form of name calling. It is a form of name calling. So I don't see why it's unreasonable for to do that. I mean, to me, it sounds a lot worse than shell game and so forth, or shell entity.
It's kind of like a bunch of kids shouting at each other, and the mother says, "We don't use that kind of language here."
I mean, judges are there partially to do that.
But I mean, some of these things, like a corporate shell, that's you can actually describe most of these non-practicing entities as a corporate shell. It's a corporation that has nothing in it.
Right.
I mean,
that sounds more like a statement of fact to me.
Right. So, I mean, okay, maybe patent troll. Maybe I can understand patent troll, because it does have some sort of negative connotation that you may not want to use inside of a court of law. But some of these things, like corporate shell or corporate shell game, that's actually just a description. That's not really a derogatory statement. Stephen, are we going to see more of this? Because, I mean, patent troll lawsuits are not going to go away. Is she blazing the trail for future judges to say, no, you can't call them bad people?
Yeah, I think, you know, you can clearly see what's happening here. I mean, you don't need a judge or a jury to see that these companies are designed literally just to troll rich corporations like Apple. And yeah, we are going to see, I mean, these cases have been going on forever and they're going to continue. So yeah, maybe that's her goal here, is to kind of set the standard in the courtroom. Inevitably, when these cases keep coming back to her and her colleagues in the system, to keep it as impartial as possible. You know, some of those terms, like you said, I mean, they're very literal, and it's hard to argue that they have any kind of bias towards them, like a shell corporation. Troll, again, like I said, I still think that's okay, just because it's in the common vernacular now, and people understand what that means. But yeah, other stuff like pirate and so forth, and maybe anything else that could be determined derogatory. I think that's good to remain impartial, especially if juries are listening to this. So it's going to keep happening, and this is setting a precedent.
I don't know. I'm going to miss hearing like pirates. I mean, look, most legal proceedings are really boring. I want to hear at least a little bit of spicy language. Now, when we come back, we're going to talk a little bit about how to become the most hated man in San Francisco. Earlier on, I had this titled "How to Become a D-Bag in Just One Day," but I was told by the people at Twit that we don't use words like D-Bag on the stream. So instead, we're going to take a break to talk about the first sponsor of this episode of This Week in Tech, and that is IT Pro TV. Now, the other show that I do, I do multiple shows, but the show I do tomorrow is called This Week in Enterprise Tech. It's all about networking. It's all about data centers. It's about how the world is connected. And one of the questions we get most often is from the odd user who just wants to know, how do I get into this? How do I start learning about the technology that connects us? How do I start a career, or at least the path towards a career, that will let me deal with some of the most cutting edge technology on the planet? Well, the answer is you need to sign up with some sort of outfit, with some sort of organization that can give you the ropes, that can let you learn at your own pace, that can teach you the information you need to know at the pace you need to know it. And thankfully, that's IT Pro TV. Now, IT Pro TV is a video network designed to exclusively serve the world of information technology. Whether you're looking to jumpstart a career in IT, or if you're already working in the field, IT Pro TV supplements traditional learning methods in a fun and engaging way that maximizes your learning and prepares you for a certificate exam. Now, hundreds of hours of contents are produced, now with 30 hours being added each week. Growing episode libraries with video courses on Apple, Microsoft, Cisco, and more, including A+, CCNA, Security+, MCSA, CISSP, now with Linux Plus and Apple certification coming in July. Now, course covers the topics like network security, Linux, Windows, OS X support for desktop and servers, and more. And episode libraries are organized by exam objectives, making it easy for you to target the areas to successfully pass the certification test that you are prepping for. Oh, even if you're studying with a book already or enrolled in a certification program or technical degree program, this is a fantastic supplement to learn at your own pace. The shows are streamed live and are available on demand worldwide to you, to your Roku, your computer, or mobile device for one low monthly price. Now, comparable to the cost of a study guide, IT Pro TV is much cheaper than going to an IT boot camp, and it's no hassle with an easy cancellation policy. Now, one of the things I really like is you get direct interaction with hosts. It's a lot like Twit in that there's a chat room during the shows. There's web-based Q&A specific to the topic of study. Now, they have over 10 years of experience in IT and learning and were inspired by Leo to create what you see here on the screen, a studio devoted to nothing but IT. They even use the same cameras, microphones, lighting, and TriCaster equipment that we do, so you'll know that they'll give you the goods. Now, they've also added a new web interface and learning management system to track your progress. You get a virtual sandbox lab environment for hands-on practice, which means you get to play with the equipment as if you were sitting in front of it before you actually have to buy anything. They also have measure practice exams included with your subscription, which are a $79 value. Annual subscribers can now also download episodes and audio-only MP3s for offline consumptions. For example, if you want something to listen to on that drive to work, why not listen to something that will help you brush up your IT skills? Corporate accounts are also available for departments and companies. Check out the corporate group pricing at the bottom of the pricing page. IT Pro has an amazing response from corporate IT departments wanting to get subscriptions for team members. So here's what I want you to do. I want you to see if maybe the world of IT is a fit for you. Check out ITProTV/Twit to upgrade your brain with the most popular certifications recognized by employers around the world. There's also a free preview on the site if you want to check out some of their videos or their live stream. Subscriptions are normally $57 per month or $570 for the entire year, but we have a special offer because they're huge fans of Twit. If you sign up now and use the code TWIT30, you'll receive 30% off your subscription for the lifetime of your account. That's less than $40 per month or $399 for the entire year. That's itpro.tv/twit, itpro.tv/twit, and use the code TWIT30 to receive 30% off. And we thank IT Pro TV for their support of This Week in Tech. Now, I don't know if you've heard about this, but over the weekend, we had a little bit of, I think it was a hate parade. Can we call it a hate parade in San Francisco?
Definitely.
And Steve, you heard about this, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So table reservations, especially on holidays, are kind of difficult to come by in San Francisco. So you know what's a really good way to piss people off? How about if you make a bunch of fake reservations and then sell those reservations to the highest bidder? Yeah, that's exactly what happened. A man by the name of Brian Myers, a developer, a project manager, and an entrepreneur in San Francisco, created a new service called Reservation Hop. Now, he says he did it over the weekend. It was just something fun that he put together. Well, the way it works is that he makes reservations at the busiest times of the hottest restaurants in San Francisco under assumed names. And then he offers those reservations for sale on his site. Now, once you pay, he will give you the name of the reservation and the time that you're supposed to show up. Now, naturally, this caused a little bit of consternation. There was a lot of restaurateurs who were saying, wait a minute, you can't do that. That's not cool. And his excuse is, well, I release the reservations if no one buys it, like 5 minutes before. And these are popular restaurants, so I'm sure they're not going to have problems filling the seats. But it seems like a real, well, it's a douchey thing to do. Harry, I mean,
it seems really sleazy, and it seems like just in the last few weeks, there have been more really stupid ideas for startups than I can remember. Like, there were those guys who were selling rolls of quarters for use at the laundromat, which they marked up, so you paid $15 for $10 worth
of
quarters.
Yeah. And
there was a whole thing in San Francisco with the apps for auctioning off your parking space when you're leaving it, which the city said is illegal. And now this guy who like Farhad Manjoo from the New York Times said that he's violating the social contract, which seems fair to me.
There's an expectation that you act certain ways when you live with a lot of other people because you want them to act the same way. This seems like one of those things where, no, dude, not cool. Just don't do it. Now, Chad, if you could bring up his website, the funny thing was he's sort of he's basking in the negativity. Actually, his blog page, the negativity that is his disaster here. He's saying, well, you know, since people started tweeting about me, calling me the most horrible person on the face of the city, my site traffic has gone up like 5,000%. Steve, let me throw this over to you because there's actually a bigger lesson, I think, here. It's not just about one person creating a really, really nasty app that a lot of people are getting angry about. It's this is kind of the state of innovation in San Francisco right now. If you look at some of the most recent startups, they're all about extracting value from things that people used to think were free. And here are some of the hate tweets that he's gotten, you know, and he likes this. Is this where innovation is headed in the Silicon Valley?
Yeah, and I think I have a unique perspective on this from an East Coaster, a New Yorker, you know, looking at it from the outside. You know, it seems like so many of these developers and entrepreneurs in the area, they just get lost in their own mind bubble that, you know, everything is ripe for disruption, including reservations. And there are legitimate services that do help you make reservations. You know, there's OpenTable, the most obvious answer. And that's a great service and it does it well. And you don't need to do anything shady. They work directly with the restaurants. And so, you know, this is akin to someone kind of like Harry said, just like finding an open parking spot and paying a guy to stand in there until someone auctions it off and bids on it and no one parks there. You know, it's maybe not necessarily illegal, but yeah, it violates a social contract. I'll quote a friend of mine on Twitter said something like, you know, he pretended he had a startup idea to stand in front of someone in a movie theater until they pay him to sit down. You know, it's exactly like that. That was actually Matt Honan from Wired who said that the other night. I thought that was really funny. And that's exactly what, you know, you see these kids come through thinking they're really just like blowing up certain industries. And they're not. You can't, there's not going to be an Uber for everything or an Airbnb for everything. And this is just, you know, it's hurting local businesses, restaurants, you know, are losing, could lose potential customers by some kid just calling around and making phony reservations. And the fact that he's bragging about it just makes it worse. And maybe he's getting more traffic on his site, but I'd be shocked if he's making any money off this.
Okay, wait. So let me take the devil's advocate's position here, because it's easy to look at something like this or like the parking meter startup that we had in San Francisco. What was that thing called?
There are a couple of them.
Yeah.
Something Monkey is one of
them. Yeah, Parking Monkey. The idea of let me take a free resource and I'll give you a little bit of service and you give me profit. And people generally frown upon this because, again, it's breaking the social contract. But the people in the chat room are quick to point out, wait a minute, what about Ticketmaster? You know, this is just another middleman scheme.
I'm not so crazy about Ticketmaster either.
Yeah, that's accepted, right?
But
they created this platform to buy these tickets. You know, that's a useful tool. They charge you way too many fees, but they did create a service. I mean, Seamless Web, I don't know if you guys have that out there.
Yep.
But it's the food delivery, a Grubhub and so forth. You know, you're still paying for the same stuff, but it's this platform and it's an actual useful tool. And they partner, keep in mind, Ticketmaster partners with the venues. Seamless and Grubhub and so forth partner with the restaurants. This guy's just going on his own and finding something free and charging people for it. And it's kind of similar to what we saw with the Aereo case. I know we're going to get to that later, but, you know, Aereo took these free signals and then charged people to beam them back over the internet. And SCOTUS, you know, a couple of weeks ago said that's illegal.
But wait a minute, isn't that the role of the entrepreneur? The entrepreneur finds things that are undervalued and makes them valuable. And isn't that innovation?
I mean, in the chat room, people are talking about StubHub, and some people have said this guy is just scalping reservations. I mean, even scalpers have to pay for the tickets, and they're taking a risk. And if you scalp tickets to a show, the theater will be okay because you paid for the ticket. And this guy does say, I believe, that he cancels the reservations 4 hours before if he hasn't sold them, which in theory means that the restaurant has plenty of time to find somebody to sit down. But it still seems like, it's the restaurant's decision. And I feel like if this guy actually does take off or if he has copycats, the way this will be solved is that restaurants will force you to give a credit card number, which some restaurants do today, especially for big nights, and you won't be able to just make a reservation for free.
Now let me get deep into the devil's advocate position, because I understand we're saying, well, this doesn't agree with the social contract that I've made with my fellow city dwellers, but I mean, is that just a matter of time? If I were to go back 20 years and say, oh, by the way, I'm developing a new company, what I'm going to do is I'm going to take all your personal information and I'm going to make it available for people to search for it, and I'm going to sell advertising against it. People would say, no, that violates the social contract. That's totally uncool,
media
bro.
Companies said that. I worked for a publication that blocked Google for a while because they felt like Google was
stealing
was
their
a
content.
Barnacle, on our content machine.
So is it just a bad idea until people start doing it? And if that case, wouldn't you want to get the little bit of hate so you could be first?
I don't think in this case. I don't think it applies okay. to this at all. Again,
I don't think so either. But I'm like, I want to push this a little bit.
I know you're playing the devil's advocate, but it's just hard to buy that. It's simply destroying that social contract we have, that reasonable expectation that anyone can call and make a reservation for free. It's not a right. It's not a legal right, but it's socially acceptable. I'm all for innovation and change and disrupting industries, but this isn't disrupting an industry. It's pissing everyone off.
Right.
And the fact he has to use fake names kind of tells you that it's not something that people think is okay.
The fruits of the poison tree, I think, is what
I'd love to know what the names are, though. And does he use a unique name every single time?
Actually, he's been using Harry McCracken.
Carlos Danger.
He also he said something about how it works 99% of the time. And I wonder what happens in the 1% of the time when it doesn't work.
Now, I think what it's coming down to is we believe, even if we can't express it, that if someone is going to make a profit, they need to have a little bit of skin in the game, right? They have to work a little bit. We have no problem if someone takes a risk and gets payoff. But maybe our problem with this guy is he's not taking a risk. He's taking advantage of a system that's there. Is that fair? Is that what we're saying? I'm confused. I don't know what I'm saying.
He's taking advantage of the fact that it runs on trust right now. Because you can make a reservation just by giving your name, there's trust there, and he's violating that trust.
I can't believe that people give me their personal information. They trust me with their pictures. I think some famous man said that before he founded some Facebook-y thing, right? So let's get back to this. Yeah. Okay, so let's step away from this particular example. Let's talk about this whole genre of innovation in particular, because that's what I really want to talk about. If this is the future of innovation, taking things that are free, making value of them, and then selling them so I can make profit. A lot of companies, and not just these small startups, seem to be based around that model. Is that sustainable?
Yeah, I mean, look at Airbnb. I think that's really cool. They're the largest hotel service in the world right now. I think Brian Chesky tweeted yesterday or the day before, they hit a record of 330,000 people staying in Airbnbs in one night. That's significant, and that is actually creating a useful service. People have rooms open, or a spare apartment, or a separate vacation home, or whatever, and they want to rent it out. And Airbnb created this excellent platform to enable that. So I think that's a great example of someone who's of a company and entrepreneurs who found. Some low hanging fruit that was ripe for disruption. I've stayed in Airbnbs before, and it's almost better than staying in a hotel in a lot of ways. It's very personal, and you get your own place and so on.
And you get to go through their stuff, which I love. That's my favorite part.
That too.
By the way, locks don't work.
Locks don't work. Yeah, that too. We hear these horror stories, but 99% of the time, stuff like that is great. Uber is another one. They found, wow, it's really tough to get a cab in some cities. Wouldn't it be great if you just whip out your phone and call a cab and anyone can hop in? And it's working. These are real businesses making real money.
Let's go to Uber, because I actually do want to talk a little bit about Uber. But before we go to Uber, we do need to take a break to talk about the second sponsor of the show, because actually we don't have to. I could delay it another 10 minutes, but I'm getting hungry. And we've got Nature Box. Would you like to choose something here? This is actually pretty good. I like the Santa Fe sticks, but try these. The toasted cheddars are actually pretty good. Now, Nature Box, if you haven't heard about them, if you haven't been onto it, Steve, would you like one? I mean, I'll put it right.
Mail it to me. Drone it to me.
There we go. That one's for you. Now, if you want to get healthy snacks, you could do it a couple of ways. You could make your own. You could dry up some nuts, maybe drizzle on some honey, and maybe grow some beets and extract the sugar out of them. Or you could go with something like Nature Box. Now, Nature Box is, well, let me surprise you about this. It's something that you should be snacking on. That's right. We always think of snacking in a negative light. We think, oh, snacking leads to weight. And trust me, I am kind of an expert in weight gain. But NatureBox is a different kind of company. They don't want to give you the stuff that's going to taste like paper. They don't want to give you the stuff that's going to make you gain weight. They don't want the stuff that's going to destroy your cholesterol, make your body fall apart. They know what your body needs and what you want, and they've figured out the secret in one simple box. Now, NatureBox snacks have zero trans fats, zero high fructose corn syrup, and nothing artificial. They send great tasting snacks right to your door with free shipping anywhere in the United States, which is why we can afford to get all these snacks in the Brick House. In fact, if you were to go back into our pantry, and in fact, we'll invite our guests to go back there later on and see what we have a row of chocolates, we have a row of sugars and sweets, and then we've got a diminishing stack of NatureBox packages. We got a couple of hundred of these things. I think we're down to like a dozen or so because this is what the Twit people snack on. I mean, when you've got something this good, this natural, you don't have to care about whether or not it's good for you. That's just sort of a added bonus. Now, here's how the process works. You've got to go to NatureBox. Chad, go and show them the NatureBox website. And what you're going to do is you're going to choose a pack that works for you. Click on the continue button on the website and you get to choose between three subscription options that will determine how much you get, how often you get, and what kind of packages you're going to receive inside your NatureBox. Once you're a member, you can select which snacks you'd like in that box, and you can also select by your dietary need. If you're vegan, if you're soy-free, gluten-conscious, lactose-free, nut-free, non-GMO, or if you're like me and you just want tasty, tasty stuff, you get to customize what comes in your box. You can also select by taste. And this is important because I didn't know this, but when you start designing your own pack, you really do want a balance between savory, sweet, or spicy. Previously, I thought, oh, snacks, it's chocolate. Does everything taste like chocolate? But no, now I can go by mood. Sometimes I want something really, really sweet. Sometimes I want something a little bit of salty with a little bit of tang. And then sometimes I just want, you know, something that's a little bit of wholesome goodness. That's what I love about NatureBox, which is it allows me to, well, plan my snacking. And when you plan your snacking, you get much healthier snacks. So here's what we want you to do. We want you to try guilt-free snacks. Things like Coconut Date Energy Bites, Santa Fe Corn Sticks, which I love, Pear Praline Crunch, and over 100 more healthy choices. Go to naturebox.com/twit and get 50% off your first box. Stay full. Stay strong. Go to naturebox.com/twit. And we thank NatureBox for their support of This Week in Tech. Now, seriously, Harry, you got to grab one of these. These are pretty good. We'll send you one, Steve.
All right.
Are you a savory guy, a sweet guy? What's it gonna be?
I'm a savory guy.
You're a savory guy.
The spicy one sounds good too.
Okay, actually, then you're gonna love the Santa Fe corn sticks. That's actually my favorite right now. They also have these spicy peas, dried peas.
The wasabi peas.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, most of this stuff, I used to make fun of it. I'm like, who's gonna eat that? But it's actually good stuff. Go figure. And you know me, if it's food, I'll eat it. All right. Yeah. Now, we were just talking a little bit about how to be a D-bag in San Francisco. Let's talk about how not to be a D-bag and extract value out of something that wasn't there before and then maybe get smacked down. And we're specifically talking about Uber and Lyft. Steve, you were just talking about Uber and Lyft. Have you actually used Uber and Lyft?
Yeah, I've never used Lyft. I use Uber a lot, both in New York and when I'm visiting San Francisco. And I mean, it's amazing, especially here in New York. If it's rainy or rush hour, you can't get a yellow cab. I mean, Uber is always there. Yes, they do the surge pricing thing sometimes, but it does guarantee you always have a car and a way to get around. I'm obsessed with it. And we don't have Lyft here, but I am curious to try it next time I'm out in San Francisco.
Now, Harry, what about you? Because I actually used Uber twice. The first time it was fantastic. I thought it was great. It got me to where I needed to go. I live in San Francisco, so I don't like driving because I can never park. But the second time, my driver got lost. We actually ended up on the road. And I kept telling him, like, I don't think this is where we're supposed to be going. He's like, no, I've lived here for 20 years. And I mean, we ended up on the wrong side of the city. And then he wanted to charge me for the entire fare. And I'm thinking, no. I mean, that's sort of the inconsistency that I can't abide. Have you been using the cars with the pink mustaches?
I have been in Lyft a couple of times and in Uber a couple of times. But I have lots of nightmare stories about cab drivers who have gone to the wrong side of town.
Yeah.
or won't go where I want them to go or charge me for their mistakes. So it's not like, I mean, if taxi cabs were a great experience, Lyft and Uber would not have an opportunity.
Yeah. I think that's what it comes down to, because when I lived in D.C., it was all taxi. We didn't have a car. You had to use a taxi if you want to get somewhere that the trains didn't go. And you just kind of expected it was going to be an unpleasant experience.
And in San Francisco, cabs in general, I have found, are particularly bad. You can't get them. You call them and they don't come. They don't know what they're doing. I once was in a cab that got into a funeral procession with me in it, and a cop rode alongside us on his motorcycle screaming at the cab driver until he got out of the funeral procession. I had a cab driver who was stopped for speeding in San Francisco.
It's funny you should mention that. Just 2 weeks ago, I had a cab that didn't have a cab until later. I couldn't get a cab because I was in my full priest outfit and I had a big cross. And I guess that's scary at 10 o'clock at night. People are like, oh, crazy person. No, I should have used Uber. Okay, anyways, let's get down to the story. So what we have is a little bit of pain and a little bit of joy for Uber. In London, Uber was in trouble because only the city's black taxis are allowed by law to use meters to charge customers. That's how they work. However, the Transport for London, which controls all that, has decided that phones on which the Uber and Lyft apps reside are not taxi meters within the meaning of the current legislation. That decision could change when another court convenes in the fall to actually decide what a meter constitutes. But the end result is that Uber can continue to operate in London along with Lyft. It's a different thing stateside. Just this last week, the Public Utilities Commission of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, has issued cease and desist orders for both Uber and Lyft. Now, both crowdsourced transportation options must immediately cease to operate in the boundaries of Pittsburgh. Unlike London, the issue is not about the technology. It's not about the meters, but it's about three issues that the PUC pointed out. The first is driver background checks. The second is proper insurance. And the third is proper inspection of cars and drivers. Now, I'm not going to let my bad experience color it. I want to hand it off to you. Steve, you first. This, you know, when people are championing Uber and Lyft, they say, well, this is really just it's a grab by the existing taxi cab concessionaires who don't want another option in the cities in which they operate. But those are actually important things. I mean, I actually started thinking about that on that second trip, which is I was like, does this guy even have a license? Does he know where he's going? The car was kind of ratty. That's not controlled under Uber. It is kind of buyer beware, right?
It is. So Uber has this platform, again, that lets anyone kind of get in and become this Uber driver as long as they meet certain standards. I think they have to have a car of a certain model year and has to be four doors and so on. But that's, and I think insured too, but I'm not sure. But, that's really all the regulation that Uber gets. They're not regulated in the same sense that traditional city taxis are. And I think the Pittsburgh example is much more relevant in the near term than the London one, just because, you know, in these cities, you kind of hinted at this, that, you know, there are a lot of players here. There are the traditional taxi and cab commissions and other black car services who are licensed, and it really bothers them when someone can just come in and take their business without being regulated the way they have to be regulated. Another part of this is, if you want to be a little cynical, it's part of the city government. You know, they want those taxes and fees from the drivers or Uber itself, and they want to license these cars. On the other hand, there is definitely a public safety issue, and this is something Uber has to tackle. Insurance, we've heard the Uber horror stories. I think there was one in San Francisco where a little girl got hit or a little kid got hit, and things like that. And, those drivers can kind of say, oh, I'm not plugged into the Uber system right now. Those need to be regulated. It is a public safety issue. So I think the answer is kind of this hybrid thing where Uber, yes, they need to eventually start only licensing their cars for public safety reasons. And then also, the city governments, there's too much influence from these lobbyists from the traditional car companies. There's a lot of money flowing in there and a lot of thuggish behavior going on behind the scenes that hasn't really been reported on.
The chat room is completely polarized. I don't know if either of you are watching the chat right now, but it seems everyone in there is either believes that Uber and Lyft are the way to go and that the Public Utilities Commission is in the pockets of the unions, or you got people who are saying, no, this is a safety thing, man. I mean, seriously, we have registered cabs for a reason. We have this regulation because it's a safety issue for the public. And it doesn't seem like either of them are willing to concede any. It's always got to be one or the other. Either Uber is awesome and we should allow it because it's the best thing ever, or Uber eventually is going to kill someone, and then what happens? It's, you know, that's a weird place to be.
Well, presumably, licensed cab drivers occasionally kill people, not intentionally, hopefully. So even if it does happen with Uber or Lyft, I don't think it means that the idea is bad.
Yeah. It's that's actually one of the things that I think has really bothered me during this entire saga, which is, a lot of people are saying, well, look, this is new. This is different. This is something that the law has to adapt to. But I see it the other way, which is, if you're going to allow for Uber and Lyft, then essentially what you're telling cab companies is you can ignore any sort of registration. You can ignore any regulation about your industry and just go back to operating as independent cabs. And we don't want that, right, Steve? I mean, that's I don't think that's what Uber people are advocating.
No, totally not. And I mean, I think the answer, I don't think this is either or issue. I think there needs to be a hybrid compromise going on here. There do need to be safety standards. And unfortunately, it's a city by city thing. There's no federal taxi regulator. It's city by city and state by state. And that's kind of the battle Uber is fighting right now. It's like every region and every city is totally different and operates differently than the next one. So what can fly in New York clearly can't fly in Pittsburgh.
But how do you have that hybrid? I mean, and that's what I don't understand. Where would the hybrid come into? Because it would seem as if the diehard Uber fans are saying, no, this is Lyft sharing, and you're tipping someone. You're helping them out for helping you out. It's community based versus the taxi cab company, which is very regulated. It's very regimented. We understand how it works. It's a known quantity, which it seems to be diametrically opposed to Uber. It sounds as if a hybrid compromise would either have to greatly reduce the amount of regulation that we put upon taxi companies, or it would regulate Uber and Lyft to the point where it's no longer Uber or Lyft.
Yeah, but I mean, it's Lyft is a little bit different than Uber, at least in my view, in the sense that it is kind of like this hippy dippy, like, hey, I'm going to throw a pink mustache on my Toyota Corolla and you go. No, they're going to run into more trouble, I think. Uber, they do have, you got to keep in mind, Uber does have licensed drivers in their network. And they do here in New York, they have yellow, like yellow cabs can sign on to Uber too. And so I think one of the this hybrid thing I'm talking about, one of the missed opportunities is New York does have a system in place for anybody to create an Uber-like app with all the, they have all the data and so forth to pull that in, but nobody's doing it, and nobody's doing it as well as Uber. That's the thing. And so, I do think there needs to be, these people do need to be licensed. They do need to make sure they're insured and so forth. But also there is this technology available out there for people to plug into, at least in New York. And so I think there is a hybrid answer.
Well, you know what? I think we can go around in circles here. Let's go to the audience. Yeah. Could I get a show of hands really quickly here? Who would feel safe putting your child, and actually if your future child, into an Uber or Lyft car? Show of hands. Oh, really? You know what? You're all going to be horrible parents. Don't. I shouldn't have done that, actually. I take that back. We're not going to the audience ever again. Obviously, they're communists. Okay. I want to break away from some of the seriousness for just a second and talk a little bit about hardware lust. Have you heard about the new Android Black phone?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's the phone built for the paranoid, Android phone for the paranoid. And I mean this in a good way. I don't mean paranoid crazy people. I mean for people who really, really want some security, the Android Black phone is pretty incredible. Ars Technica got their hands on a release of the Black phone. And from what they can see, the hardware is not all that great. I mean, it's decent. It's a 4.7-inch IPS screen, 1280 by 720 resolution. It's got Private OS, which is a fork from Android 4.4 KitKat. It runs a 2 gigahertz quad-core NVIDIA Tegra processor with a Tegra 4i GPU. It's got 1 gigabyte of system memory, 16 gigabytes of storage, plus a micro SD slot, an 8 megabyte rear, 8 megapixel rear, 5 megapixel front camera, 2000 milliamp hour battery, comes for about $629 unlocked. So that's the hardware, which is, that's basically what, mid-range Android phone?
Mid-range.
But where the magic comes in is what is built into it. It's got a 2-year subscription to Silent Circle's secure voice and video text messaging services. It's got 3 1-year subscriptions to Silent Circle that you can gift to people who you want to communicate securely with. 2 years of 1 gigabyte per month VPN service from Disconnect. Disconnect's automatic anonymous search service baked into the browser. 2 years of SpiderOak secure cloud storage and sharing with 5 gigabytes a month of transfer. And some cool software, including one called Kismet Smarter Wi-Fi, which keeps the phone from being spoofed or connected to untrusted networks. It learns the location of your trusted networks by noting its location via the cell tower it detects, and then it can't be tricked into connecting to a rogue AP that's trying to slurp your data. Now, of course, encryption is built in. Heavy end-to-end encryption on everything that you do on this phone, and the whole idea is this is the phone you want to use if you're tired of people looking at your data. Now, Steve, would you pay $629 for this?
No. I mean, I'm a specs geek, too, so I want a more powerful phone. But also, I mean, I think this is a very narrow audience they're going after. Kind of like you said, the paranoid folks who really think people are going to be spoofing their Wi-Fi or whatever. And then again, you know, it's also how secure is it, you know, with that new NSA story that came out. You know, they can dig into anything, it seems like. I'm no security expert, but it does sound like at least the standard Android and iOS, and especially iOS 8, has some really great features that provide a lot of this already out of the box. But you know, for certain people, I think this will be a decent option. The so-called paranoid folks.
I'm going back and forth, wondering if, because I mean, it's not a poorly designed phone. It looks like it's pretty well integrated with all the security features. But I'm wondering if they're just trying to take advantage of the security scare right now. People are so freaked out that everyone is listening to everything that you have on your phone. That's what they're doing. They're just taking advantage of that. In which case, I really don't like it. But like you said, Steve, a lot of these security features you could just load on your current phone. So the only reason why you would get this is if you really believe that there are so many backdoors into your device right now that you want a clean OS that has been forked off of the main. Oh, Harry?
Well, I mean, Steve is right. I think the more interesting thing is Apple and Google and hardware makers doing some of this stuff, because that can reach far more people. And Apple is doing stuff like, I guess it's scrambling the MAC address when your phone reports itself out, which sounds like that's going to be really good in terms of security. And it's going to be something that every person who has an iPhone will take advantage of, whether they know it or not. I mean, the black phone is something that you're going to buy if you're a hardcore privacy and security kind of person, which most people aren't. Most people would rather that their phone did the heavy lifting and didn't make them have to think about this stuff.
Yeah. And actually, that's a good point. We do have another story about security on the Android device. Now, you may remember that in the latest update to iOS, Apple changed the way that the Wi-Fi system works so that it automatically anonymizes the MAC address, which means that someone who's trying to track you via your MAC address won't be able to do it. At least they won't be able to do it quite as easily. However, there was a story about how the EFF has approached Google with what seems to be a pretty serious flaw in the way that Google handles Wi-Fi connections. So right now, if you take your Google phone like this, you know, I've got mine here. Even though I'm not doing anything on it, because my Wi-Fi is on and because I'm not connected to any networks in this area, it's constantly broadcasting names of networks that I have connected to previously. And the reason why it does this is it wants to be able to really quickly establish that network connection when I do turn it on. So as a result, if I was listening with the right device, I would see the names of all names and the MAC addresses of all the APs that your device is connected to. And if I have a big enough database, it means I could actually track your movements throughout the day. That's kind of scary. That actually goes away with the Kismet Wi-Fi manager on the black phone, because the black phone will automatically anonymize and spoof your address so they couldn't do that. Now would you buy it, Steve?
Yeah, if I was a only Android user, you know, that is a little troublesome. And I think Apple is doing something here that Google isn't, and that's, like Harry said, just doing the lifting in the background for people so they don't even have to think about it. I think that's the answer. I'm not sure if buying a brand new $630 phone is the answer. You know, it's on Google and the Android developers to make sure this happens right away. And I think EFF has a very good case here, and they raise a very legitimate concern. Now, the chances that somebody is tracking your movements this way, very slim. But I'd like to see Google do what Apple's doing and just err on the side of caution and do the work for users.
Web 5088 in the chat room says, look, the Black phone is all about exploiting security theater, which I actually think he has a good... You know what? I'm going to give the audience another chance here. We're going to cut back to them. How many of you are concerned about being tracked on your device? You know what? I got to stop going to the audience. My goodness. Oh.
You know, some people say that Apple is in a better position than Google to take a lead on this because Google's business is about watching what you do with your devices and monetizing it through advertising. And because Apple is a company that sells hardware, they don't have that incentive to kind of keep track of what you're up to. And for them, it's kind of an easy decision to err on the side of privacy. But I would love to see them get enough kudos for that Google has to match what they're doing.
Right. Right. Any last words, Steve? Are you further concerned, or do you agree with Web 5088? This is just security theater. This is another way to sell an expensive phone.
Yeah, I think it's just a way to get people to buy an expensive phone. I mean, there's probably a very, and I'm sure they know this, a very small group of people who'd be interested in it. But for most people, your standard Samsung or HTC phone will be just fine. And then again, it is on Google to, you know, really take this issue and just build that into Android like Apple did.
Yeah. All right. Well, I was hoping people would be more paranoid and more hating of both security and Lyft and Uber, but I guess I'm overruled. All right, let's move on to a little something about New York's anti-cyberbullying law. You may have read this week that in November of 2010, Albany County enacted the nation's toughest cyberbullying laws in response to a young man posting pictures and nasty comments of his classmates. Well, they just struck it down. New York's highest court has come back and ruled that the ban on cyberbullying was overly broad. Now, they made it clear that the law could actually be enacted. You could build anti-cyberbullying legislation. They just thought what Albany did, which would allow for the criminalization of any form of harassment, electronic harassment, punishable by $1,000 a fine or 1 year in jail. They thought that, the way that you worded it is just not right. I think this is back to the law of unintended consequences. Steve, have you followed this case at all? Because 2 years ago, it was big, you know, when the law was first challenged, people started saying, this will actually be a good case. Can you legally outlaw cyberbullying when it seems to be a constitutional fact, a constitutional right to be mean?
Yeah, well, there's mean and then there's threatening. And, you know, we've heard numerous examples over the years of, you know, suicides from cyberbullying and self-harm from cyberbullying. So it is a very real and very serious public safety issue. But yeah, I've been following it a little bit, you know, just tangentially. And I mean, the law as written didn't seem overly broad. I think it was very clear what constitutes cyberbullying. Yeah, we have it up on the screen right now. I don't know how more narrow you can get. Maybe Harry has an opinion on that, but you know, it literally describes what cyberbullying is right there. And I think it's very easy to detect, and with a reasonable person can detect what constitutes cyberbullying and what doesn't. And I think that law spells it out pretty well. So I'm curious to read that whole court's opinion and why they think it's overly broad.
Yeah, that's what had me so puzzled, because if you look at the Chad was actually just showing you what the legislation says. Cyberbullying was defined as any act of communicating by mechanical electronic means, including posting statements on the internet or through a computer or email network that disseminate embarrassing or sexually explicit photographs, disseminate private, personal, false, or sexual information that include hate mail, or include information with no legitimate private, personal, or public purpose with the intent to harass, annoy, threaten, abuse, taunt, intimidate, torment, humiliate, or otherwise inflict significant emotional harm on another person. So they defined what it is, they defined what's included, and they actually added intent. There has to be an intent to harass. It can't just have been a random posting. I mean, Harry, how do you get more narrow than that?
I mean, it seems pretty clear to me. And I mean, online harassment is a really serious issue. And in general, I err on the side of being sympathetic to the people being harassed rather than the harassers.
Yeah, I don't know how to take this. The case was started back in 2011 by a young man by the name of Marquis Meggs, who in 2011 created a Facebook page that included pictures of his classmates. And if I remember properly, he was writing things like slut or, you know, sleeps around. It was stuff that a 15-year-old would write. It was designed to be hurtful. Obviously, he was trying to make fun of these people. And he pleaded guilty to cyberbullying, which is a misdemeanor. Now, he challenged on First Amendment grounds even after pleading guilty. But since the Court of Appeals has agreed 5-2, that the statute was overly broad, his conviction is now voided. So let me throw this over to you, Steve. Is there no way to outlaw cyberbullying? Because it is currently on the books of over a dozen states, a dozen counties. Is there no way to say, hey, stop acting like a jerk?
Well, I mean, keep in mind, this is only New York. And like you said, there are probably other states and municipalities where this is, there are laws. And I think the New York court did say that, okay, we are open to having such laws. It just needs to be super narrow. I don't know what else Albany can do. I don't know how, this is really and truly baffling. And like Harry said, I mean, I don't have kids, but I have colleagues and friends who have kids. And it is a very serious problem, especially in that age group, you know, 10 to, let's say, 16 or whatever. And, you know, there have been a lot of high profile cases and stories over the last few years of just that cyberbullying and pretty much people following that law or, you know, doing what was described in the law to the letter. You know, that case in New Jersey, I think it was the Rutgers student who killed himself after being cyberbullied. Right. That was huge and very sad story. So it is an important kind of law to have. It's just very unfortunate that the Supreme Court in New York didn't think it was.
You know, the chat room is pretty clear that they're all saying, look, people are jerks. You can't do anything about it. And others are saying, look, you know, it's a thought crime. And how do you police thought crimes? And others are saying kids will be kids. But I mean, what strikes me is when we actually start talking about cyberbullying today, most of the time, we're not talking about children. Remember, the repeal of this law also applies to revenge porn. Revenge porn is a form of cyberbullying. So if you live in Albany and you break up with someone, you can now post graphic videos of your former without worrying about being thrown in jail. I'm not saying that, you know, that it's kind of strange for me to talk about that, actually.
You shouldn't do that, but you can, I guess.
Yeah, yeah.
It's not good.
Any last words on cyberbullying, or are we just agreeing that people are jerks?
I mean, it's yet another case where no matter how well-intentioned you are and how reasonable you are, it is really hard to write laws on any of this stuff. Even in cases where, such as this, where I think you should write those laws, it's still not easy.
All right. Well, let's move away from cyberbullying because that's a downer. Let's talk a little bit about Google buying Beats. No, that totally didn't happen. No, actually, they bought songs after weeks of quiet speculation, which is quite a change from what we had come to expect from the acquisition of any sort of music company. Google has acquired Songza, which is a Long Island-based music streaming service. Now, though the exact price of the acquisition is unknown, it's reported to be somewhere north of $15 million, which, wait, if I do my math, carry the one, is less than $3 billion. Now, here's the interesting thing. Mike Elgin, our very own Mike Elgin, wrote a very interesting piece about the acquisition in which he was saying Google just showed Apple how to do a music acquisition. Now, of course, that title was a little bit of a link bait, but let's think it through. What Beats was a premium manufacturer. And what Mike pointed out was that all of these music companies are looking for what's called the 360 sell. You can't make money off of music anymore. You make money off of the things that are attached to the music. That's what Apple was after. You're after the cred. You're after the after sell. You're after for that upsell. But what Mike was saying was, like, look, Apple already had that. They had a very valuable brand. They didn't really add anything new with Beats. Well, all they got was a music streaming service. And Google just got one of those for 1/1000th of the price. And in Songza, they get something that's different. You know, Beats directly competes with something like Spotify or with Pandora. But what you get with Songza is the human curated playlist, which is unique. That no one else does that. And it is something that's different. It is something that Google can integrate into their 360, which is advertising. Now, so Harry, I hate to use Mike because he's one of our own. He's not even here. But do you think this was Beats done right?
Well, I think it's kind of apples, no pun intended, and oranges in some ways. Not the least of which is because Apple got this, you know, large hardware brand, which is doing extremely well at selling expensive devices, which you plug into other Apple devices. I think Songza is very cool, and I kind of worry that it's going to be like a lot of other Google acquisitions where they kind of really wanted the talented people behind the service, and they're either going to let Songza languish or they're going to explicitly shut it down at some point. But I would like to think that they see value in the idea of human curation because there are all these music services curated by algorithms, and they just don't have as much personality as the best stuff curated by a person.
When I
was driving up here from San Francisco, I was listening to music curated by human beings rather than something like Pandora. And I think I enjoyed it more, and I learned more about stuff I might want to listen to because of that.
I had a very interesting conversation with some geeks last night. I was doing a hangout, and one of them said, you know, with Google buying Songza, I could totally see them integrating this into Google Plus because Google Plus is all about human curation. It's all about people bringing the best stories to their groups. Can you imagine if they integrated Songza into G Plus so that people could make playlists and those playlists could be recommended to Songza subscribers? I'm not saying that's what they were going to do, but I mean it does seem to naturally fit what Google's trying to do with human interaction. Steve, thoughts?
I disagree with that.
Good.
Putting Songza into Google Plus will just ensure that no one uses Songza again. Google Plus is, I mean, I know people are going to disagree with me on this, but it is a ghost town unless you're one of those hyper-connected. Yeah, I said it. But, you know, separately from that, you know, it's funny that all these weeks later, we're still talking about the Apple Beats acquisition and trying to make sense of it all. But I think, you know, you look at the Songza streaming music service and you look at Beats. Songza, like Harry said, you know, it has this unique thing. It's curated by humans. And you know, when everyone was talking about the Beats acquisition leading up to the official announcement and figuring it all out, this video of Jimmy Iovine at one of the All Things D conferences surfaced, and he was talking about curation and how technology can enable curation. And they're going to create this amazing product, which turned out to be Beats Music, that can do this curation naturally as if a human were doing it. Well, I mean, if you've used Beats, it's not really that. It's mostly just a Spotify and RDO clone. And Songza does just that. Songza is humans making these, you know, perfectly curated playlists. And it's awesome. I don't know if you haven't used it, you should. And you really do get that cool experience of listening to songs in that perfect order, you know, just like you're listening to a vinyl or something like that. So I think Google really did win this in this. If you're going to compare the two acquisitions, I think Google, yeah, they got a better service, a better streaming service for way cheaper. And hopefully they do something really good with it. I don't want to see it implemented in Google Plus. I'd like to see it in Google Music or something. I think that would make a lot more sense. And, I think that's the next frontier in this digital music is really nailing that curation and bringing back that experience of listening to the radio and having that perfect playlist. And I think Songza does that way better than Beats.
Yeah, I do think that Google got a deal. They got a steal in getting Songza for, what, 15, 20 million, whatever it's going to end up being. But when I was talking about the 360 business model, and when I was talking about how Apple got a premium brand in Beats, I will say that some of the audience members right in front of me were nodding their heads as if they understand what that's all about, the getting that premium hardware. Now, I don't trust the audience anymore because they've let me down twice. but you know, I think people, even though, yes, Songza, dollar for dollar, Google got something better. I'm not talking down to the Beats model because I think Apple probably made all that back off of Beats already. So go figure. Harry, last words.
Well, Beats does have at least a dash of human curation as well. They do have playlists, but Songza seems to be doing it better than anybody else. And I would never want to see human curation die. And I would love to see the possibility that it might be the next big thing. Yeah. And Google, and Google has the opportunity to do that if they want to make it happen.
Indeed. When we come back, we're going to be talking about something. I don't know. We're going to look through the dock and figure out what I want to talk about next. But before we do that, I thought now might be a good time to take another break to talk about the third sponsor of this episode of This Week in Tech, and that's Audible. You know them. You love them. They're the ones who give me all the audiobooks I use. I drive 2 hours a day. That's my commute, which may not be a lot to people who have actually had to work in the real world for the last 20 years. But for me, when I'm used to living at the place where I work, 2 hours it's kind of unbearable. And so most of the time I'm alone with my thoughts, unless I've got a decent audiobook from Audible, because it's obviously become my favorite way to consume books. Now, This Week in Tech is brought to you by Audible.com. Now, we offer special benefits for This Week in Tech members of our audience. For those who need two audiobooks, you can give Audible a try. And today, Audible is giving you a special deal. If you go to their site, if you type in our code, if you click on our link, you'll get two audiobooks for free. That's right, for gratis, for nothing, just for trying out the best audiobook service on the planet. This gives you two free audiobooks, two credits to try out, and two book credits per month, which is a nice way of saying Audible helps you to keep reading, which is what we encourage for the TWIT audience. It's also a great deal for people who enjoy listening to audio programming. And as with other plans, the plan that you'll get by signing up with Audible through our link, you'll get a free subscription to the Wall Street Journal or the New York Times daily audio program. Now, the book that I've been listening to, and this is actually something that I've recommended on several of the programs that I've been on, when there's not an Audible ad, is a book called The Martian by Andy Weir. Now, Chad, you've been listening to The Martian as well, right?
I finished it.
You finished it? I think I'm like my 12th round through.
This is so good.
Okay, so let me set the stage for you. Have you read The Martian?
I have not.
Steve, have you heard about The Martian yet?
No, I never even heard of it.
Okay, so here's the setting. Mission to Mars sometime in the very near future. None of the tech is super futuristic. There are no warp drives. You know, they're using good old-fashioned physics to get you to the red planet. There's a snowstorm. Oh, not snowstorm.
There's a snowstorm
on Mars, but this is not
everything
futuristic.
Everything is so realistic.
There's a sandstorm, a dust storm, that happens on Sol 6, day 6 of the third mission, the Ares mission to Mars. And they have to evacuate. And as they evacuate, one of the astronauts is struck by the communication dish that's torn off and flies into him. So the other five evacuate thinking that he's dead. Of course, it turns out he's not dead. He's on the red planet. And for the next glorious 10 hours of the audiobook, you get to find out if he survives. Now, the nice thing, what I really like about this, and this is sort of what I like about all sci-fi, smart sci-fi, figuring out how to fix the problems. And if you listen to it, he's actually using technical means that we have available to us. In fact, I'm going to play a little something. This kind of typifies the humor that you're going to hear from the book.
Everyone knew Brendan Hutch would be running missions soon. He'd risen through NASA's ranks as fast as one could in the large, inertia-bound organization. He was known as a diligent worker, and his skill and leadership qualities were plain to all his subordinates. Brendan was in charge of mission control from 1 a.m. to 9 a.m. every night.
That's so good.
Continued excellent performance in this role would certainly net him a promotion. It had already been announced he'd be backup flight controller for Ares 4, and he had a good shot at the top job for Ares V.
"Flight, Capcom," a voice said through his headset.
"Go, Capcom," Brendan responded. Though they were in the same room, radio protocol was observed at all times. "Unscheduled status update from Hermes." With Hermes 90 light seconds away, back-and-forth voice communication was impractical. Other than media relations, Hermes would communicate via text until they were much closer.
"Roger," Brendan said. "Read it out."
I don't get it, Flight," came the confused reply. "No real status, just a single sentence."
"What's it say?"
"Message reads, Houston, be advised. Rich Parnell is a steely-eyed missile man."
Now, if you want to know who Rich Parnell is, you got to get the book. Now, seriously, this is my favorite book since Ready Player One. And I really, really enjoyed Ready Player One. So if you like hard fiction, if you like science, like actual science, not just stuff that's pulled out of the air, you got to pick up The Martian by Andy Weir. You're going to find it on Audible as one of your free downloads. And I think that's all we have to say about that. So if you want to find out what happened to our fearless astronaut, if you want to find out what the Rich Parnell maneuver actually is, go ahead and subscribe to Audible. For more details or to get two free audiobooks and their platinum offer, go to audible.com/twit2. That's audible.com/twit2. Now, gentlemen, we got a little something-something here about, T-Mobile, the Un-carrier, now with more bogus fees. I'm assuming that you heard about this, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So last Tuesday, the FTC filed a claim against cell carrier T-Mobile, claiming that the fourth largest U.S. carrier was cramming. Now, you may not have heard of cramming. If you're an old timer like me and you grew up in the time of the landline, you know cramming because cramming was actually big back when we didn't have cell phones. It's a practice of loading a customer's bill with hidden charges for carrier and texting services and then trying to cover it up with language that purposely obfuscates what it was for. The FTC says that T-Mobile has reaped hundreds of millions of dollars from premium texting fees that were not authorized by the customers. Now, the premium services amounted to about $9.99 per user per month, and the premium services included things like Gestra Digital, which is accused of deceiving customers with antivirus scams, Wise Media, specializing in horoscopes, Tattoo, which was known for celebrity gossip alerts. Now, here's the fun part. T-Mobile was charging the fee even after they were determined to be fraudulent, pocketing about 40% of the monthly fee for themselves and forwarding the rest to the service providers. Now, in November of 2013, all four of the U.S. major carriers were approached by the FTC, and they agreed to stop billing for the premium tech services. However, according to the FTC, the practice continued at T-Mobile at least through December 2013, most likely through January 2014. Now, this is one of these things that it gets my goat. I'm a T-Mobile subscriber, but I have a prepaid bill, so they can't charge me for these services. But I can't imagine how easy it would be to hide $9 if you've got a bill of $120, $110. That's kind of what they were counting on, right, Steve? I mean, that most customers don't want to go through the 50 pages of bills.
Yeah, and you got to keep in mind, this is a very deep and complex issue. And it goes beyond just these premium texting services. But you also got to keep in mind, it's not just T-Mobile. Yes, the FTC is going after T-Mobile, but Verizon, Sprint, and AT&T were doing it too, and they all kind of decided at the same time, okay, we're going to stop our relationship with these premium texting services. So then the question becomes, okay, so why is the FTC picking on T-Mobile? Well, I've spoken to the FTC a lot this week about this story. One reason is, yes, T-Mobile said they stopped doing it, and they're going to, you know, do their best to refund people, but they want a court order that, you know, they want it on paper legally, that such cramming charges, not just for the premium texting services like those ones you described, but any kind of cramming cannot happen again. And they also want to make sure that everyone who was affected by these practices gets refunded, which might not necessarily happen because right now T-Mobile, it's kind of, you know, come to us if you think you were fraudulently charged. They want T-Mobile being more proactive and paying literally everyone. So there's a lot to unpack here. But basically, the FTC, this isn't the first time we're going to hear from this from the FTC. And they're really going against this cramming thing. And it's these services are intensely sketchy. And the way they skim your phone number and they cut these deals with the carriers. What I'd like to see is the carriers to come out and say, we're going to stop all third-party billing from third-party services, which isn't happening yet.
Right, because until they do that, Harry, it's like whack-a-mole, right? I mean, T-Mobile got caught this time, but they're not the only carrier doing this. We've seen this from Sprint, from AT&T, from Verizon. The idea of hiding charges in the bill, which is why every month your bill is slightly a different cost because they've hidden the charges a different way. It's an time-honored tradition.
And the only reason they can do this is because phone bills are incomprehensible.
Yeah, Chad, we've got a picture. Go ahead and go to that excerpt from an actual T-Mobile bill and tell me. I mean, because there's a lot of people who are going to say, oh, this is stupid. I mean, if you can't pay attention to your bill, if you can't look and make sure that you're paying the right amount, then it's your fault. But look, this is what an actual T-Mobile bill looks like. Now, that $9.99 is hidden as a usage charge. Now, you may have paid $85 the previous month and $93 this month, but you're just thinking, I don't know, it looks right. And if you scroll down a little bit, Chad, it's 123 pages until you finally find out where that $9.99 charge came from. So,
and even then, you don't really know.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, look, I mean, you're looking at Shaboom Media. Did I buy something from Shaboom Media? Is it an app? Is that what this is? Even though, yes, there is an element of buyer beware here, there is an element of you need to do your due diligence, this is not a new phenomenon. This is something that's been happening with not just the cell phone carriers, but all carriers since we had the first spam phone call.
I mean, presumably they could do things that would help, like have some sort of system where before you get billed for this stuff, there's some sort of double opt-in, so nobody can ever claim that they weren't aware they were agreeing to get their horoscopes on their phone or whatever.
Right.
I mean, I think in some cases, people may have agreed to do it knowing they were agreeing. In some cases, they may have been confused about it. In some cases, they may have been crammed on with it without the customer knowing about it at all.
And one of these is a Facebook scam. So you download a Facebook app to your phone and they offer you something for free. So supposedly it's a way to get Facebook updates to your phone more quickly. And, you, of course, there's a EULA, and you go right to the EULA, and you click OK. And in that EULA is, oh, by the way, you're agreeing to let us charge you $9.99 a month. And then that charge gets forever hidden, and it's almost impossible to cancel. You have to track them down, call a number. There's no online forum. In fact, actually, Xbox Live used to do this before you can cancel it. And that's the most maddening part. Steve, you say that, you know, we need to stop the third-party charges, but they'd never do that, right? Because they make way too much money from that.
No, that would be killing the revenue. And that's why the FTC is getting involved and the FCC. You know, the FCC is seeking potentially punitive damages towards T-Mobile in a separate case. So, you know, it's kind of sad that it takes some kind of government intervention or government agency intervention to stop this practice. And it's a long battle. It was funny. I talked to a Sprint spokesperson this week about it. And she framed it as, oh, well, we use this third-party billing to make it easier on the customers so they don't have to go through a separate billing process. And it's clear they're skimming revenue from users whenever they can. And ending this practice, any kind of third-party billing, will just put a huge ding into their revenue because it's also on these third-party services. You know, there's if you're watching Comedy Central late at night or something, you see those weird commercials like, oh, just text this number to get like flirt tips or something. You know, it's very easy for someone without knowledge of the situation to just fall into that trap and text that number and not know exactly what they're signing up for. And reading the fine print. And that's kind of why the carriers ended the relationship with at least these texting services, because a lot of them didn't make it clear what people were signing up for simply by texting a certain number. But it's also on the carriers to be upfront about how they're billing people, and they're not quite doing that yet.
And it's especially hard on T-Mobile's reputation because their whole marketing message is we're the uncarrier, AT&T and Verizon are the bad guys, but we, T-Mobile, are on the side of you, the consumer. And I'm not sure how they overcome the ding to their reputation, no matter how much it's deserved or is not deserved.
We are the uncrammer.
And that's my theory now is, you know, like I said, all the carriers are doing it. But my hunch, and I've asked the FTC about this, they wouldn't say, but my hunch is they're going after T-Mobile because T-Mobile is that, you know, very loud, very noisy marketing message now that, you know, we're here, we're on your side, and, you know, we're going to eliminate all the pain points that carriers have been giving you all this time. And yet they got caught doing the exact same thing as the other carriers. So I think they're kind of like the straw man right now for the FTC. Even though they're not alone doing it. And I'm not saying they shouldn't go after T-Mobile. They totally should. But T-Mobile is the perfect choice if you're going to sue one of the carriers. T-Mobile is the perfect choice right now because of that really strong marketing message. It makes a big point.
Right, right. It's more damaging, and so therefore they want to deal with it more quickly. That, mm-hmm. that makes sense. Now, I am going to go out on a limb here and reach out to the audience one more time. I know I shouldn't do this, but it's the definition of insanity. How many of you have actually gone through your phone bill to find hidden charges and then disputed them? It's always the one guy. except for the one guy, that kind of shows the point, which is this is what they're counting on, right? I mean, they're counting on us not caring enough to go and track down the errant charge. So even if most of us, even if my regular bill is $89 a month, this month it was $100, I'm going to be thinking, I'm not going to waste time. I'm not going to waste 5 hours out of my life to track down $9. I'm just going to let it sit there. This dead air. This is what we're doing now.
I mean, it is. It's remarkable, like how many things in the world are easy to sign up for and almost impossible to opt out of. I've spent more hours than I can think of on the phone with Comcast and my phone carriers and all kinds of other people. You generally speaking cannot do this stuff online. Mm. But with like one click, you can sign up for these services.
Sadly enough, I think we just don't care enough. I remember when I used to really care about being flocked and fleeced, and now it's sort of like, okay, yeah, I get it. I'm going to take it some way, so this is a small one. All right, let's move on. Let's get away from that because that's starting to get kind of nasty. Steve, let me ask you this question. Have you ever sent an email and then really quickly realized, oh my God, just as I sent that hit that send button, I should not have sent that email. That was a horrible, horrible mistake.
I do that several times a day, probably.
Yeah, I think so. I think everyone
maybe
has
not a horrible mistake, but it's like, oh man, I had a typo or something that I wish I had fixed.
A typo? Yeah, okay, typo. Harry, have you had that? Like sent out an email you really didn't want to?
Maybe once or twice.
Yeah, typo or?
The thing I do occasionally is when I'm sending an email about somebody, I accidentally address it to them. And I've never done it in a way that was super embarrassing. But
okay, so, you know, typo, maybe misaddressing something.
And Gmail does have that feature where you can, like, for a split second after you send a Gmail.
Take it back.
You can take it back. Which yeah. I've taken advantage of.
So, I mean, those are pretty serious. You know, typo. Or, you know, the wrong addressing. What if you accidentally sent a secure customer list that contains all the secrets about your company's security to a totally random Gmail user? Yeah, that's what happened to someone from Goldman Sachs. On June 23rd, a Goldman Sachs contractor accidentally sent a Gmail message containing, quote unquote, highly confidential brokerage account information to the wrong Gmail account. The contractor had been testing changes that the bank had made to become compliant with the requirements set forth by the Financial Industry Regulatory Authority. The email contained the contractor's report, which he meant to send to a GS.com account, but which he says his browser accidentally auto-completed to gmail.com. On June 26, realizing the mistake, Goldman Sachs asked Google to delete the email message from their servers. Google's incident response team responded that the email could not be deleted without a court order, but in compromise, Google blocked access to the email while Goldman Sachs sought a court order to delete the email message. So let me start with that. Automatically, so Goldman Sachs got a mulligan. They got a do-over. They got to do something that none of us can do, which is they froze the email after it had been sent out. First impressions from the panel, do we have any problems with that?
Yes. I think that's a very slippery slope to give a mega corporation with a lot of power that kind of preferential treatment. If I you know, contact Google and say, oh, I wish I never sent my ex-girlfriend that email asking for her forgiveness or something, like they would laugh at me. But, you know, the fact that, you know, this company is coming through and touting FTC regulations and a bunch of scary jargon, they get that preferential treatment. And I think, you know, right now it's probably an innocuous email that probably said nothing. But the fact that they were given that preferential treatment makes you wonder what could happen in the future.
Yeah, I think that's what strikes me about that. And Harry, I want to throw this over to you. The way that they got Google to freeze the email was that they said, and get, quote unquote, again, emergency relief is necessary to avoid the risk of inflicting a needless and massive privacy violation upon Goldman Sachs clients and to avoid the risk of unnecessary reputation damage to Goldman Sachs. But then I think, wait a minute, if this was a contractor who was sending a report about whether or not they complied with regulatory rules, there shouldn't be any customer information. There's no major database here. The only thing that could be that it could possibly be would be embarrassing in that he said, no, you're not compliant right now.
And what is Goldman Sachs doing using an email system that can even talk to Gmail
right.
to send this kind of stuff?
Exactly.
They should block Gmail for anything like this or not send it via email at all. So I'm not deeply bothered by this, probably, maybe to the extent that Steve is, but it's totally true. If you or I had a similar request, we probably could not get Google on the phone.
Well, I mean, I think what bothers me is that it's obvious that Goldman Sachs is talking up the concerns so that they could get this embarrassing email frozen. You know, there's no customer information. There is no massive privacy violation upon Goldman Sachs clients because there's not going to be any information about Goldman Sachs clients unless this external contractor for some reason was sending back and forth a list of Goldman Sachs clients, which, okay, then they've got another problem, which is they've got really bad contractors. So it's as if corporations now have this special button that they can push where they say, oh, privacy violation, and Google will do their beck and call. That really rubs me the wrong way. Steve, are you like me, or do you have a different reason for thinking that this is a slippery slope?
No, I'm totally with you. And again, you know, these are also the companies that were largely responsible for our financial meltdown. And, you know, to give them that kind of preferential treatment just rubs me the wrong way. And also, it's a little worrisome that Google has that power to tap into one's inbox and prevent you from reading an email. The fact that they can do that because a company requested it, I think that's pretty bothersome too. You know, you can think of numerous examples of how that could be abused. So it gives Google a lot of, again, acting like the arbiter and deciding case by case what when they should exercise this power to stop you from reading email that goes into your inbox. That's crazy to me.
Yeah, some people in the chat room are saying, I don't understand why this is a big problem. But Brian W. in the chat room, I think he brings forth the big issue for me, which is, well, the reason why they can do this is it's not your inbox. It's Google's, right? I mean, because if it's Google's inbox, they can do anything they want. They could freeze the email. They can delete it after a court order. But if you believe that it's your inbox, you should be upset that Google can reach in and freeze a particular email.
It's not your inbox to the same degree that, you know, an IMAP inbox where you can download stuff to your own hard drive is your own inbox. And I kind of hope whoever received this actually did download it before Google was able to tamper with the inbox. But you should never think of Gmail as being the same as your own inbox because it's just not.
I don't know. I'm incensed. I'm pissed. I think this is a major breach. In fact, okay, Chad, bring up the audience again. Let's give them one last chance. How many of you think that this is a gross invasion of your privacy that Google has this ability? Okay, yes. Okay, see? We got mostly a right answer. Thank you very much. Finally, the audience pulls through. I understand what you're saying, Harry, but, you know, I don't feel like that. I do feel... My mail is my mail. You don't have a right to go through my mail without a court order. Even if Goldman Sachs says something really bad is going to happen if someone reads that email message, it doesn't mean that they have a legal right to freeze that email message.
The good news is Goldman Sachs looks like a total bunch of doofuses.
They do.
Because this became public. And
yeah.
I hope it's at least as embarrassing for them as if the information had gotten out because they deserve it in this case.
Steve, last words.
Information was probably nothing. Yeah, the information is probably nothing, first of all. And Harry is like technically correct, yes, that Gmail does own the inbox. And if you want to be super safe, you should download it all. But, you know, we do put a lot of trust into this company. And the fact that they get to, you know, play judge and jury and decide when you get to read emails sent to you or not, that's a little bothersome. And, you know, again, if you want to go into the NSA stuff, and all that kind of backdoor dealing, that's also worrisome.
Well, Google, just remember, if you really want to freeze that email, the only thing to do is to nuke me from orbit. It's the only safe way. Now, when we come back, we're going to wrap up with a little bit of Microsoft rumors, because that's how I like to do it. But before that, let's take a little break to talk about the last sponsor of this episode of This Week in Tech, and that's Squarespace. Now, do you want a single place that you can go to get everything that you need to get your creative ideas onto the internet? Now, I know there are a lot of people out there who like a bit more control. So maybe you're going to buy your own domain name registrar. You're going to buy your own hosting company. Maybe you want to set up the back end. And that's fine. That's great. We love geeks who want to do that. But there are a lot of people who don't want that hassle, who go through that because they have to, not because they want to. There are more people who just want one easy stop, one service, one place that will take care of everything and get that idea, that project, that picture, that photo, that video onto the internet. And that, folks, is Squarespace. Now, I have used Squarespace constantly over the last 3 years, ever since I started hearing about them, because, well, their sites never go down. And so whenever I've done a job for a parish or a university or a high school, and they don't have a lot of technical people, they don't have a lot of people who want to do the programming, I always say, well, why go through that trouble? Why not get yourself a Squarespace site? Now, the reason why I love Squarespace is, multifold. First of all, they're always improving their platform. They're not content to sit on what they had a couple of years ago. They're always giving you new designs, new features, and even better support. They've got beautiful designs, 25 custom templates for you to start with, and they recently added a logo creator tool, which is a basic tool for individuals and small businesses with limited resources who want to create a unique identity for themselves. It's also incredibly easy to use. Squarespace is always there for you when you need help. They have live chat and email support 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Plus, there's a completely redesigned customer help site for easier access to self-help articles and video workshops. Squarespace also offers e-commerce solutions, now available for all subscription plan levels, including the ability to accept donations, which is great for nonprofits, cash wedding registries, and school fund drives. That's exactly what I've been using it for. It's also inexpensive. It starts at just $8 a month and includes a free domain name if you sign up for a year. Squarespace is also mobile ready. You may have seen some janky websites that look okay on a desktop but look horrible on a mobile device. That's because they're not dynamically coded to change according to the device it's being viewed on. Squarespace does all that for you. The Squarespace Metric app for iPhone and iPad allow you to check site stats like page views, unique visitors, and social media followers, and the site will automatically adjust to look as good as it can on those mobile devices. Even the code is beautiful. We all know that the Squarespace sites look beautiful on the outside, but what's amazing is that the code underneath is just elegant. Squarespace takes as much pride in their code as they do in the front end. Now, of course, because it's a one-stop shop, Squarespace also includes hosting. So you don't have to. You don't have to worry about a separate bill. It's all in one place. So here's what we want you to do. We want you to start a 2-week free trial with no credit card required and start building your website today. When you decide to sign up for Squarespace, make sure to use the offer code TWIT to get 10% off and to show your support for This Week in Tech. We thank Squarespace for their support of This Week in Tech. A better web awaits. It starts now with your new Squarespace website. Let's get to the rumors. This is the part that I like. Unsubstantiated tech. Now, Tom's Hardware claims that they got a little sneak peek. They got some skivvy. They got from someone in the know about Microsoft's smartwatch research. And they think they know what the face of Microsoft Entry is going to look like. And guess what? It's not a watch. First and foremost, Microsoft is not pitching a smartwatch. They're pitching what they're calling a smart band. Think of it like a Nike Fuel band, but just a little bit wider. Now, it will reportedly have 11 sensors, cross-platform support, so it's going to work on a Windows Phone, Android, or iOS. It's got a slim band design that is more akin, again, to that Nike Fuel band than to a Pebble or a Google watch. It doesn't actually look like a banded watch. It has open APIs, so you're going to be able to program for it quite easily. A screen, this is what's what I really like, that is inside the wrist, not on the top of the wrist. So it's here rather than here, and it will launch sometime after October. Steve, I got to say, if these rumors turn out to be true, the thing that most excites me is not the API, it's not the sensors, it's that the screen's on the inside. I mean, for me, that makes a whole lot more sense than having to do this. This we don't do anymore because we don't wear watches. This feels perfectly normal because this is also how I use my phone. What are your takes?
When I heard that rumor, the first thing that came to my mind was, I don't know if you're familiar with the Samsung Gear Fit, but it had a curved screen that goes on the top and it was super awkward to look at like this. But if it was on the inside of your wrist, it would have been so much better. So this kind of makes me think that it's going to be like a curved screen similar to that, but it's more natural looking on the inside. So that's probably why they made the design choice. But what excited me the most, I think, is I've been using Android Wear, where I stopped using it after I wrote my review of it, but I was using it for like 4 or 5 or 6 days. And that thing just drove me crazy. And it was because it was just constantly setting notifications. It was constantly buzzing my wrist with every like tweet and email I got. And I didn't really find it useful because it just mimicked everything that was already happening on my smartphone. Here it sounds like Microsoft is taking the smarter approach and focusing on fitness, which is really important. And those fitness trackers, as we know, like Jawbone and so forth, they're very popular and very useful. What I assume is just a very limited notification thing on that screen. I feel like that would be create a much better product than the smartwatches and smart bands or whatever you want to call them that we're already seeing. And it also sounds a lot like the iWatch. You hear rumors of 10 or 11 different sensors. I mean, that's the same thing we're hearing about the iWatch. It's going to be able to, you know, detect everything from your hydration levels to your glucose and so on. If Microsoft is doing the same thing and making it cross-platform and they do it well, that could be really huge.
Harry, do you care at all about smartwatches, smart bands, smart devices on your wrist?
Well, I'm wearing Android Wear right now. And actually, yesterday night I was at the movies, and it kept going off, and it was really bright. And I actually I rotated around and put it on the other side of my wrist just so that I could kind of go like this. So the idea of somebody intentionally designing a device like that sort of makes sense to me.
Harry McCracken, and the smart band was his idea.
I do worry a little bit, though, about Microsoft doing this because they have so many major fish to fry and problems to solve. And it's kind of hard to imagine a Microsoft band being an enormous product that saves the company.
Yeah, but see, I don't need an enormous product that saves the company. What I like is it's actually something different. There's so for the last 15 years, it's always felt as if Microsoft / Intel were a step behind. I mean, they had the tech, they had some decent design, but it was like, okay, well, that's popular. Let's make one of those. This is finally something where they're saying, look, a watch is stupid. We're not going to build you a watch. No one wants a watch, but would you take a band that has a different kind of screen? It's not like one of these big clunky screens. It's going to be super, super thin, and it's not designed to operate like a watch. It's designed to operate like an extension of your phone. That I kind of like that. I like forward thinking. Even if it doesn't come through, at least they're trying something that's not what Apple or Google did.
It would be a great story if the Microsoft smart band at least competed on the same level as the iWatch.
How awesome would it be if it outsold it?
And Microsoft keeps saying that it's a company about supporting multiple platforms, and it's nice to see them putting their money where their mouth is and not building something to be used with your Windows phone. Of course, they have every incentive to support Android and iOS in this case, because if it did only work with your Windows phone, the market would be really small.
Absolutely. Steve, what about it? Are you going to get both the iWatch, the next Google Watch, and the Microsoft Watch? I mean, you probably will.
That's something I have to wait and see. I mean, the best example I can think of is, you know, I wear this, so the Jawbone Up, and I'm obsessed with it. And that's because it does a few things, and it does them very well. It tracks my steps, it tracks my sleep, and I can type in and track, you know, when I go to the gym and track my workouts. And that's amazing, and it adds value. You know, today's current smartwatches don't add any value. They're just a $200 thing you slap on your wrist that does the same thing as your smartphone. And, you know, there's so many reports and rumors about the iWatch and the Microsoft band or whatever you want to call it. It sounds like they're taking a much better and much more intelligent approach to this wearable device category than we've seen Google and Samsung and Pebble do. And that's what excites me. I'm not saying it's going to save Microsoft or be the next big computing platform. But if this is going to be a popular category, I think the approach that Microsoft and Apple are reportedly taking, that's the right approach.
Yeah, I do like that. I think I agree with you. Now, one last bit before we say goodbye, just because I was really into the World Cup. I didn't think we were going to use this, but I think we are going to use it now. We all know that defacing is bad, like graffiti is bad, tagging is bad. But something happened to Wikipedia last week, right after the United States lost to Belgium in the World Cup. And that is the Wikipedia page for the United States Secretary of Defense was changed. Chad, if you could go ahead and bring that up. The Wikipedia entry was changed from the current incumbent Chuck Hagel to Tim Howard. Now, though Wikipedia does not tolerate any defacement of entries for any reason, even Wikipedia mastermind admitted that the prank was quite exquisite. That does it for this episode of This Week in Tech. I want to thank our panelists for joining us. Harry McCracken, Can we officially say that? Oh, I'm sorry. Chad is pointing at me. Does that mean that we have a week ahead?
Yeah. We have the past week.
Okay.
We have the little promo.
All right. Hit that.
You ready to roll it? Here we go.
Previously on Twit.
We're not going to light up like 40 of them at the same time. That is such a bad idea.
You did what?
You are insane.
Security Now.
To keep things simple, buffers are always larger than the maximum space we need.
The company should just say, insert hack here.
Know-how.
We're going to teach you how to turn this into something like this.
This is just Chad getting revenge.
It's alive! And break. Whoa!
Windows Weekly.
There's also going to be a pro version of the fitness band.
Yeah,
that
I think
you both called the Windows version. Shackles.
Yeah. That's when I give up.
Coding 101.
I like how your makeup looks.
I like how your makeup looks, too.
Oh, it's fudge.
It's fudge.
I was eating chocolate this morning.
This Week in Enterprise
Tech.
Stop
it! The chat room is off to your left. Jeez. You can look in there, but I would
make
mostly
the pain stop.
They see me trolled. And
if you missed Twit this week, you missed a lot of pod rage. Ow, 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 ow.
Do you ever sleep?
I guess we did this to Chad a while back, and I guess this is sort of his revenge.
When Leo is away, at least one of us will play, and this week it was Padre.
My goodness. No, that's what I get. See, Steve, if you ever work for a network like Twitch, just make sure you never put yourself out there, okay? Because you're going to get stepped on. Oh, but I do want to thank the two of you. Now can I talk about them?
Yes, go ahead.
Okay. Harry McCracken, technologizer, but no, now we're saying that you're working for
Fast Company in 2 weeks. Technologizer will just kind of be a place where I have fun on the side, but mainly Fast Company starting 2 weeks from tomorrow.
And of course, they're going to find you at Fast Company, but where else can they find you if they want to check out your work?
On Twitter, for sure, at Harry McCracken. On Google Plus, sort of. On Facebook, kind of, although it's mostly the same stuff I put on Twitter. Yeah. I'd say Fast Company, then Twitter, then Technologizer moving forward.
All right. Well, we have got you all planned out. And also planned out is Mr. Steve Kovach. Thank you so very much for coming in. I know you're busy, and I thank you for coming in on a July 4th weekend. Same to you, Harry. Where can people find you?
Yeah, you can read my stuff, businessinsider.com/SAI. That's the tech section. And then follow me on Twitter at Steve Kovach. And yeah, that's the best way.
Thanks. Thank you. And you'll probably find him on future episodes of Tech News Today and Tech News Tonight. We keep going back to the well that is Steve Kovach. Don't forget that you can always find us live every Sunday at 3 o'clock p.m. That's 6 o'clock Eastern or 2200 UTC. You want to find us live, go to live.twit.tv. And as long as you're watching us live, why not jump into our chat room at irc.twit.tv? It's a fun part of Twit where you get to interact with the host. In fact, you've heard me call out to the chat room. It's that kind of relationship. Also, you can find our shows at twit.tv/twit. Go ahead and drop by. You'll see not just all of our episodes, but also the show notes. If there was a story that you really want to read up on, you're going to find it at twit.tv/twit. Also, did you know that I'm actually on this network like more than just Twit. You're going to find me, actually, I guess you do, because Chad decided to play that video. You can find me Mondays at 2:30 p.m. Pacific time for This Week in Enterprise Tech, where, again, we get to talk about technology, we get to talk about network, we get to talk about data centers. On Thursday, you'll find me both at 11 o'clock for Know How, which is a show about makers, about DIY, and at 1:30 for Coding 101, which is all about bringing you into the world of the Code Monkey. And finally, on Friday, it's an unofficial show, but stop by at 7 o'clock p.m. Pacific time for Padres Corner, where we'll get to jib-jab about all the tech news that slipped through the cracks. Until next time, I'm Father Robert Ballesair, the digital Jesuit, in for Leo Laporte, the tech guy, and another Twit
this is
in the can.